طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Metsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we are featuring my interview with Palestinian activist, author, documentary filmmaker, and professor of anthropology, Amal Bishara. Amal Bishara is assistant professor of anthropology at Tufts University. She filmed the documentary Across Oceans Among Colleagues in 2002, which follows the advocacy efforts of the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists on behalf of journalists in the Middle East. And she has written a book, Backstories, about the role Palestinians play in gathering and reporting of the news that comes out of Palestine. In her book, Backstories, Amal writes about how journalists work in the West Bank and demonstrates how the production of U.S. news about Palestinians depends on multifaceted collaborations, typically invisible to Western readers. She focuses on the work that Palestinian journalists do behind the scenes and behind the bylines as fixers, photojournalists, camera people, reporters, and producers, to provide the news that Americans read, see, and hear every day. I spoke with Amal in her office at Tufts University. Well, first, thanks very much for your willingness to come again on This Week in Palestine.
Well, thank you for having me.
And what I'd like to talk to you about is the role of Palestinians in gathering the news for the Western media, or gathering the news mm-hmm. for whoever, mm-hmm. and how dependent the Western media is on Palestinian journalists to really get their stories. Mm-hmm. And now you address this in Backstories, which is a wonderful book, a very informative book. And so I think it's important for us to understand what role Palestinians play. Mm-hmm. So what were you trying to do with Backstories? Tell us about.
Well, I was really interested in looking at the production of U.S. news. Obviously, there are a lot of analyses of news texts. They're biased this way, they're biased that way, so on and so mm-hmm. forth. And not to say that, that's a very valuable enterprise to look at that. And obviously, our media institutions and our media texts are structured by cultural presumptions about Arabs and Muslims that we are very familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. And by the war on terror that we're very familiar with. I wanted to do something a little bit different than that by looking at how news is actually produced on the ground. And I thought that would be a good way of showing, first of all, an unexpected place of exchange and partnership and collaboration between Americans and Palestinians. But at the same time, a way of showing how, once again, the same power structures emerge in that collaboration. So Palestinian journalists, work as reporters, photojournalists, camera people, guides, translators, so on and so forth. They have a tremendous amount of expertise that they bring to the topic matter, and obviously to sort of the lay of the land, to getting journalists where they need to go, language, so on and so forth. But they don't usually get to determine the narrative that the news stories will take. Right. So once again, they're being used for very specific skills and not given the permission to narrate the story overall, to use Edward Said's phrase.
What are the options for Palestinian journalists? I mean, one wants to be a journalist, mm-hmm. one studies to be a journalist. We know there's some possibility with Western media, but what are the options for a Palestinian journalist that's coming, quote, into the market?
Mm-hmm. Certainly better now than they were 10 or 15 years ago, right, mm-hmm. with the burgeoning of the Arab satellite news stations. and really, like, you know, increasing and increasing in number. Palestinian media tends not to have a lot of resources and is also restricted by the Palestinian Authority. International media, you know, Western media offers good salaries, but doesn't offer the possibility of people writing a lot of stories and sort of telling stories from their own perspectives. Working with Arab media stations perhaps is, at this point, one of the best options for people because they offer decent salaries and also, you know, a person gets to sort of narrate a story in her or his own voice. To a certain extent, you know, to the extent that any journalist gets to do that. So I think that's sort of the main options out there.
Are these permanent jobs? Are they so often journalists are paid, you know, picked up temporary for this, that, or the other. And in terms of their ability to have a career that is stable, is that much of an option for Palestinian journalists?
I think it varies from institution to institution. There are a bunch of permanent jobs working with international media. A lot of people will work as stringers or fixers to be paid by the day, in part because it actually offers them more independence in deciding who to work for, or sometimes taking on working with a particular, like, for example, a book author, somebody who's going to do something more specialized that they might find more interesting. But obviously one has to have the, you know, financial wherewithal to, you know, step away from a more steady salary. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly there are staff positions in, you know, the news agencies and with some of the biggest newspapers and other outlets.
What kind of risks do Palestinians face in terms of trying to get journalists to the story, trying to deal with the Israeli military that may be involved in any kind of story? What kind of risk in terms of how they're viewed by Palestinian society? It seems to me they're skating a little thin ice here, you know, trying to do a good job as a journalist without necessarily in any way being seen as collaborating or whatever with the Western media. Just, is that an issue? Is that
definitely the biggest risk faced by Palestinian journalists is from the Israeli military occupation, right? Just during the last Israeli assault on Gaza from summer 2014, 7 journalists were killed while they were working. Mm-hmm. Another 8 were killed while they were not working. It's very telling because to me it says that, you know, okay, journalists are at special risk, right? Yeah. However, being a Palestinian living under occupation, particularly during these times of war, is in itself risky, right? So in some ways I think that the skills that Palestinian journalists bring to the job and the risk that they face actually mirror the skills and risks of being a Palestinian living under military occupation in general, which is something I could say more about. But so, you know, Israel, in addition to the Gaza war from 2014, Israel was regarded as one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist for 3 years running in 2002, 2003, and 2004 by the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists. You know, those were times when journalists were being killed you know, at protests or in incursions. So that was obviously a major problem. Yeah, so, you know, Israel presents a major danger to Palestinian journalists in general. In terms of the dangers sort of navigating between sort of different political positions and different kinds of institutions in Palestinian society and in the West, I don't think that that's posed a major problem for most Palestinian journalists. For a few reasons. First of all, because some Palestinians think that, you know, there need to be Palestinian journalists working with U.S. and other Western journalists because they will help present the story better than it would be presented. Mm-hmm. Right? It may not come out perfect, but it's better than it would be.
Right?
That's one thing. The other thing is that everybody also knows that, you know, the economic situation for Palestinians is really, really difficult. Working for international organizations, media institutions, and other ones provides a good income for people. People understand that, you know, even if a Palestinian journalist can't have a major impact on the way a story is being told, you know, they're supporting their family just like everyone else is trying to do. So I don't think that Palestinian journalists face a lot of criticism from other people in their society for the kinds of work that they're doing. Yeah. Once in a while, people have faced criticism, but it has not been any serious threat.
Yes, this issue of covering stories in Palestine with the Israeli military is very real. I, remember a year or so ago interviewing a young woman who was trying to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. She'd gone to Beer Zeit University. She came out and she worked as a journalist for a while, and she had so many close calls, so many, you know, frightening experiences that she finally gave up journalism. And subsequently she came here, but, you know, she talked about the fear, the constant danger, and it finally became too much for her.
There's no security for journalists.
You know. One can understand that, you know, young woman coming out, you know, facing that kind of thing. It's just incredible.
Yeah, no, Israeli soldiers, unfortunately, have been given impunity. I mean, nobody's held; they are not being held accountable when they shoot journalists.
Right.
So we can't expect the problem to end until Israel holds accountable the soldiers who are perpetrating this violence.
Yeah.
We need to think about a systematic problem, you know, until Israel holds them accountable, which they certainly do not do.
Right. I want to go back and touch on something that you mentioned earlier, and that is the way the story finally comes out.
Uh-huh.
I remember in 2001, the first time I went to Palestine, mm-hmm. The group I went with met with Charles Sennett, who at that point was the Middle East bureau chief for the Globe.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very critical. I mean, this poor guy came, and we were talking to him, and we said, you know, the way these stories are being presented in the Boston Globe, and what we're seeing here is just as different as night and day.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about the problem of, even for him, of writing a story and having it edited, just at that level,
mm-hmm.
To say nothing of the levels below in terms of what the actual facts are, the filters that you go through,
mm-hmm.
finally ending up with the editor making the final cuts, and the story comes out, and he said this is an enormous problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand how frustrated the folks in Palestine get when they present the facts or set up the interviews, and then it goes through the filters and becomes something quite different, and that's, I think, what we're seeing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are a number of problems. One is, what do we think of as news, and what do we think of as politics? Which is, you know, we tend to follow leaders and what they say and do. We tend to look to explosions and where they happen, and obviously the casualties that they cause. There's a reason to pay attention to when people die, obviously. However, the Israeli military occupation and Israeli racism and colonialism do not just occur in terms of physical violence. They also occur in terms of, you know, systematized violence that happens every day at a million different sites, right? And that's much more difficult to write about as news.
Yeah.
And so I think we're kind of, you know, journalists are always going to be facing that kind of a barrier as they try to describe the situation. You know, we often hear about journalists saying, well, I can't write the whole history of the Middle East conflict in a, you know, a 500-word article. And that's 100% true. We don't expect them to do that. A sort of separate problem is that they also can't write about the everyday forms of violence that people face living under a colonial system, a highly militarized colonial system, because it would be kind of writing a day in the life all the time, and that's also something that our journalists are not expected to do. And American readers don't really have a context for understanding colonialism and military occupation, and so, you know, you can't just plug them in quickly with one kind of a paragraph or something like this. So I think there's a fundamental problem with what we consider news to be. Obviously, there's also a separate issue of how Americans expect the Middle East to be covered through the lens of the war on terror. And you know, obviously that in some ways started in 2001, but in many ways, you know, goes back much further, and also relates to Orientalist notions about how Arabs in the Middle East behave and their relationships to speech and violence. So I think there are a lot of reasons why the coverage that we see coming out of the out of these Jerusalem bureaus is really doesn't cover the story with the depth that we would expect, or from the angles that we would expect.
And then there's the problem of quote balance,
uh-huh,
or
right.
And you address it as objectivity, the mm-hmm. so-called objectivity of mm-hmm. the press that we sort of expect, and that the press addresses sometimes. They want a balanced story, but mm-hmm. the balanced story is not balanced because of the asymmetry of the conflict there.
Right.
That is, it's often presented that two equal powers here
right.
Are in conflict, and so we're going to get someone on one side, someone on the other side. Bang, balanced objective story. And of course, this is an issue of a colonizer and a colonized
mm-hmm.
and the asymmetry. And so that balance becomes imbalance. And you've addressed this. Would you just speak to that?
Yeah. So objectivity is obviously this really big word that does a lot of work in a lot of different places, right? But the interesting thing about objectivity is it necessarily means different things in different fields. You know, for a filmmaker to be objective requires very different techniques and standards than when we think about a lab scientist being objective, for example, or when we think about a journalist being objective. Or even, I think, you know, there's a difference between what it means to seem objective if you're covering a U.S. presidential race versus if you're covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or even if you're covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as opposed to covering, you know, apartheid South Africa, for example. Objectivity, it seems to mean the same thing in all these different domains, but in fact, it means something different wherever you look. So that's like a trick. And when we see that kind of a thing, when we see one word mm-hmm. meaning so many different things, it's definitely a call to sort of step up and do some more work about why objectivity as a concept, as a word, has so much power. And what kinds of assumptions are being smuggled in when we use words like that.
Yeah.
So one of the things I think about in terms of coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that objectivity, if you look at American objectivity in journalism, historically, a scholar named David Mindick has argued that it's made up of five things. Now I've got to see if I'm going to get all five mm-hmm. of them. One is nonpartisanship. One is sort of a reliance on information. And this is sort of how it developed through the 1800s. One is the inverted pyramid, the inverted pyramid structure, which in some ways has a tendency to seem more objective than a story, because a story kind of a narrative story will pull people in a particular way. We wait for the end, mm-hmm. and it has sort of a different pull. Not being a part of the events, and balance. Okay. And it turns out that if you look at coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, definitely the most important of those values tends to be balance. Actually, you read a fair number of narratives in journalism of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because it is a very high-status journalism, and so you get more literary journalism covering mm-hmm. this conflict. So, you know, oftentimes objectivity in the coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is thought of in terms of balance. And how do you create balance? You talk to an official on this side, and you talk to an official on that side. Or even you talk to an expert on this side and an expert on that side. But the problem with that, of course, is that these are not two equal sides, right? They're not two equal sides in terms of their political power. And I think, you know, if one is looking at it from the perspective of human rights or from the perspective, from an anti-colonial perspective, you know, they're not morally equivalent either, right? So looking at them in that way is very problematic. The other problem with balanced objectivity and thinking of this as, you know, an issue that has two sides is that, of course, the two sides themselves are internally diverse. And also that we tend to, you know, when you think of two sides, you make that same mistake of thinking about politics in terms of officials and leaders, and not in terms of sort of people who are living their lives in these political situations. Because it would be much harder to think about it as two sides, you know, if you look on the ground. And as you've mentioned, for example, thinking about Palestinian citizens of Israel or, you know, Israelis who are... you know, Sephardic versus Mizrahi, Mizrahi versus Ashkenazi, you know, and so on and so forth, right? All the differences in Israeli society. So the two sides model doesn't work for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if I could say one more thing about this, I think the other problem with the two sides model, this balanced objectivity model, is, you know, you sit down to read your newspaper in the morning and you see a quote from, for example, you know, a Palestinian farmer, and then a quote from an Israeli farmer, for example, or a quote from an Israeli mother, and then a Palestinian mother, and da-da-da, back and forth. And you can almost imagine that those people are in dialogue, because they sort of seem to be in dialogue in your page. But the truth is, in fact, the military occupation forestalls a dialogue, you know, in many cases, because Palestinians from the occupied territories are not allowed to go into Israel, and, you know, Israeli Jews and, you know, don't and are not allowed to go to the occupied territories. And Israeli Palestinians are also not legally allowed to go to the occupied territories. So, in fact, separation is a part of this system. And so when we read these news articles that seem to create dialogue, it also sort of in a very subtle way makes us think that there's a dialogue or an exchange going on or that's possible, when in fact that's just not possible.
Yeah, and then we have to deal with the bias of not only the newspaper, whether it be the New York Times or whatever, the editorial, the bias, the final editing bias we talked about a minute ago, but also the bias of the reporters. And just recently we see with David Brooks, you know, the revelation that, you know, not only does he go to Israel at least once a year, etc., but his son is serving in the military, as I believe Ethan Bonners did, who was...
Steve Erlanger. Ethan Bronner. So sorry.
Yeah.
Ethan Bronner.
So we have that to deal with. And Judy Roderin, is her son in the military also?
No, their children are quite young.
Oh, okay.
Mondo Weiss.
I thought there was one other. I was going to pin three on the New York Times.
No, her children are very young, but, you know, her family is very much a part of the Israeli establishment.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, there was an article in Mondo Weiss about this.
Yes.
Talking about Bronner and Brooks. There is a third one who goes unnamed in that Mondo Weiss article. And that Mondo Weiss article notes that Judy Roderin's children are too young to be in the army.
Yeah,
so we can wait and see.
I thought there was a third, but I guess it's unnamed at this point. Or
yep.
Something.
Yep.
Okay. So there's that issue. Well,
I mean, in a sense, my feeling on that is we have to think about that from a few different perspectives. Why does the Times keep sending people who have such intense connections to the Israeli Zionist establishment to be reporters where ostensibly their job is to cover Israeli society and Palestinian society? You know, I think there are a lot of reasons. One is they're kind of comfortable with it, apparently, on a political and, you know, philosophical level, perhaps because the United, you know, American society, they see it as sort of aligned with Israeli society. We can't put that aside. They apparently are okay with that. The other thing is, on a very practical level, in order to cover Israel, you have to have somebody who will have connections within the Israeli security and intelligence community. You know, and the people who can do that are the people who have those connections, right? I wouldn't be a good reporter for the New York Times trying to cover Israeli society, I presume, because I wouldn't have those inside connections. You know, in Israel, where so many people have been, you know, most Israeli Jews have been, you know, the vast majority, there's a draft, have been in the Israeli army, you know, having those connections is sort of your ticket in. And you wouldn't be a good reporter if you didn't have them. So there's a bunch of different problems that lead to that. From my perspective, the op-ed pages in particular, you know, should welcome a columnist who has experienced, for example, military occupation. And not just because they'll be better columnists on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but because, you know, if you have a good knowledge of Israeli military occupation, presumably you'll also do a really good job covering, you know, Iraq and the effects of the military, the U.S. military occupation there, Afghanistan, and, you know, the whole military, you know, all of these different incursions and military operations that the U.S. carries out in different places. A person who has experience under military occupation will have a critical lens on all of those kinds of operations that would be extraordinarily valuable to the Times and its readers.
But also what's very obvious is, you know, not only does the Times not have a journalist or a voice of someone living under military occupation, but it rarely has a voice from the Palestinian narrative at all. You very rarely will see an Ali Abu Nima or a Rashi Khalidi or Joseph Mossad or to say nothing of people in Palestine. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd think at least they would do that. And it's so rare that we see anyone reflecting the Palestinian narrative, that when it happens, it's a big deal, and it shouldn't be for a newspaper like the New York Times.
Right, right. And you see the effects. I mean, David Brooks' recent puff piece on Netanyahu, of all people.
Oh, my God.
I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, how is that a respectable position for the New York Times to take to allow him to continue to do that kind of work?
It's embarrassing.
Without having somebody else with a different perspective.
Okay, well, I want to change the subject. And I want to talk about some of the work you're doing now on an issue which really, really interests me. And I'm sort of interested in the fractured Palestinian society. It's fractured It has a community in the West Bank, people living in the West Bank. It has Palestinian Israelis, citizens of Israel. 20% of the population of Israel are Palestinians. It has that community. To say nothing of Gaza, it's a community completely separate by, it's worse than the separation, but you know, between Israel and the West Bank.
Yeah,
Gaza, as we all know, is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the communities in the refugee camps in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, mm-hmm. you know, spread out. And of course, the community in the diaspora you have that are all Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And the attempts for those communities to even communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, you know, because I know that you're working, I think you're working mostly with Israeli Palestinians and West Bank in terms of some of it. But I'd love to talk about the problem that Palestinians have in terms of unity, attempting to have any kind of sense of unity or even modes of communication to try to, you know, pull their country together. And you've identified that, and it's something that I've dealt with somewhat on this week in Palestine.
Uh-huh.
Whenever I hear voices trying to deal with that, so.
Well, I mean, I think the condition of Palestinian fragmentation is the condition of Israeli colonialism,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, obviously, you know, Palestinians would have a diasporic, would have diasporic communities no matter what, but most of the Palestinian diaspora refugee communities were, you know. Those communities were created by the Nakba of 1948 when Israel was established. The divisions between Palestinians in the territories occupied in 1967 and Palestinians inside Israel, who we often call 48 Palestinians, are certainly separated as a result of Israeli policies. And then, since around 1994, Palestinians in the West Bank and Palestinians from Gaza have been separated from each other by Israeli policies. Palestinians in Jerusalem also are separated from Palestinians in the west of the rest of the West Bank because Israel has annexed East Jerusalem and given them a different status than Palestinians in the rest of the West Bank. So Palestinians are fragmented because of these different Israeli policies and events, historical events, since 1948. That said, Palestinians have not, unfortunately, our leadership has not done the work that needs to be done to create a polity that can think about its common goals and work together towards them, and has not been able to also, as you mentioned, sort of create the conditions under which Palestinians from these different places can even communicate with each other, right? The PLO used to do a better job of doing that. Even so, it wasn't ideal. For example, being a member of the PLO is illegal. In the occupied territories and in Israel. And so Palestinians who were living under Israeli rule couldn't participate openly in the PLO, but they did still participate. Some mm-hmm. people did. And so the PLO was an organization that was able to bring all people, all Palestinians together, provisionally,
Particularly under Arafat, it seemed to me there was the visibility of the PLO and the acceptance in the international community that they, quote, represented the Palestinian people, unquote. That was accepted in some places and not in others.
That was the accomplishment of the PLO, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
That they made themselves recognized as the representative of the Palestinians on the world stage. And the thing that undermined that, unfortunately, is the Oslo agreements.
Yeah.
Right? The Oslo agreements, which turned a liberation movement into a state-building movement, and a failed state-building movement, of course, right? So in 1994, with the establishment of the Palestinian Authority in parts of the West Bank and Gaza, we have a recentering of sort of the momentum and the leadership in those places, and the Palestinian Authority comes to be the sort of the public face of Palestinians on the world stage.
But does not represent.
No, it only can represent.
To any degree, what the PLO... supposedly, it does not represent the people in the camps or the in the diaspora or whatever. So that the replacement of the PLO by the PA, which to some extent is what's happened is to disenfranchise or an awful lot of Palestinians.
Absolutely, right. So the PLO gained its legitimacy by trying to represent all Palestinians. Obviously, it had to work very hard to get that legitimacy because it's not a state organization and, you know, so on and so forth, right? In a world where it's meant to be that states represent people, right? And that's meant to be the only way that people are represented, right? Mm-hmm. The Palestinian Authority, in a sense, switched modes of how to legitimize representation. They did it, for example, by holding elections, right? And they did it by looking more like a state, but they were never a state, because they never had sovereignty, right? And, you know, of course, when they had the elections, only Palestinians, you know, in the West Bank and Gaza could participate in them. So in no way could the Palestinian Authority claim to represent, as you say, right, Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians mm-hmm. in the camps, other refugee communities outside of the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, that is the fault of Arafat and all of his, you know, all those who were around him and those who came after him. You know, Arafat allowed himself to be the chairman of the PLO and the president of the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. That is not a good move for a liberation movement, and it's certainly not a good move towards building some kind of a democratic polity. So, you know, from the beginning of Oslo, that problem was present, and it has only sort of become exacerbated in the last, you know, 20 years.
And then you have the political split of Hamas, mm-hmm. Who are sort of in power in Gaza.
Yeah.
And in the West Bank, they're there, but not in power. I think they're very visible, obviously, but you have that split also,
which is a total shame, right?
And the sham of the elections, which of course elected Hamas, and then we didn't like it, so we're not going to recognize
yeah.
it. And so we have, I mean, that kind of fracture also.
Again, a result of both Palestinian yeah. leadership's mistakes and mm-hmm. a result of pressure from the outside, right? So. You know, in a way, the Fatah-dominated PA put in a place, you know, where it was pressured to separate from Hamas because the elections were not being recognized and all aid was being cut off by, you know, by the international community. Israel was no longer handing over taxes and so forth. So it was put into a position of crisis, right, that led, in a way, to the split between Hamas and Fatah, or Gaza and the West Bank, but also... you know, and you could go much further back and say that, you know, Israel's policies of separating Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza, physically separating them, meant that there was so little communication across those two communities that when that dire split happened, it seemed less dire because in some ways the split was already in place. Now, obviously, Palestinian leadership has the responsibility of, you know, repairing these things and moving forward. Because Palestinians are living in crisis, right? Living in, you know, extremely violent circumstances, and leadership need to, you know, band together to ameliorate the situation of those Palestinians, right? Instead of being lost in these mm. in these splits, right? We need to rise above those pressures.
But it's in Israel's interest to keep the community fractured. So you just try to sit back and mm-hmm. and say, in the best of all possible worlds, if we could somehow unify the voice of Palestinians in the West Bank and in Israel and in Gaza and in the camps and in the etc. But if you try to imagine them doing that,
yeah.
what would Israel? I mean, Israel just would not allow that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it's yeah. against the interests. I mean, it's in the interest of Israel to mm-hmm. perpetuate that fragmentation. You know, I think that it's partly about, again, Israeli policies of division and delegitimization of leadership, almost all the Palestinian leadership, and, you know, obviously working very closely with Abbas and you know, relying on him. But I think it's also, to a certain extent, about capitalism and the sort of capitalist nature of our media systems. You know, if media are going to rely on, for example, advertising revenue, you know, there's no common Palestinian market, for sure, right? So where would the advertising revenues come from for a Palestinian media, right? There's no common Palestinian market. So how could you even imagine that? So I think there's a lot of pressures that perpetuate this kind of division.
Oh, and I think there are, you know, besides the military, which is in there guarding the separations,
uh-huh.
You have the use of collaborators,
right?
And the way that that's used in Israel among Israeli Palestinians,
absolutely,
to keep an eye on what's going on in the West Bank, whatever. But the use of collaborators, Palestinians have to deal with all the time. And we in the West don't think about it so much, except increasingly Palestinian films have been dealing with the problems of collaboration, and it's a very difficult problem. If you're someone, you have a family to protect, and they're threatening your family, they want information, if you don't give us information, we're going to get your family, et cetera. They already have them in prison. And just the use of collaborators and settlers, I mean, in terms of keeping the Palestinian society sort of imbalanced and on their heels. And so you have the military, you have settlers, you have the issue of internal collaborators, and you're trying to deal with unifying.
Right.
You know, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation to be in. Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's interesting that films are taking this up.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad they are, because until you sit through, and it's torture to sit through some of these films.
Right.
Because you think of yourself, you think of your own family, you think, my God, if you're put in the same place, what would you do? And it's just excruciating.
Well, in some ways it speaks to, I mean, I think one great thing about Palestinian cinema is that it's able to represent some of the texture of everyday life under Israeli rule, which, you know, again, doesn't get it into sort of the front page news stories as often as it should, right? And so cinema really can do that.
It can.
It lets you immerse yourself.
And there is, you know, we're finding that there's an increasing vibrance of Palestinians.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the film festival here, but even beyond the film festival, we just went on Netflix and we sort of tried to find Palestinian films, and we found, something like 40 of them or something.
Just amazing.
I know. Various qualities, but, you know, so we put them on our list because, you know, and it's like, you sit and watch Palestinian cinema for a while, and you're going to begin to get a picture that you're not going to see in the New York Times or the Boston Globe.
That's amazing. And then it's amazing that Netflix, you know, I mean, the new technologies are allowing that kind of thing to happen. All those films wouldn't fit in your corner blockbuster, right?
Yeah.
But Netflix makes it happen.
No, and it's, you know, it's fabulous. Well, in terms of trying to see any kind of light at the end of the tunnel here, and looking for something that trying to unified voice here, or unified movement, some of us look to BDS.
Uh-huh.
Look to what's going to change, you know, the narrative here. What's going, and trying to organize in the international community, trying to put pressure on Israel. And it's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is, in some ways, beginning to move Israel, who's feeling now they have to respond to that. What's your feeling about BDS and the role it might play in this, you know, sort of trying to get some kind of unified response?
Yeah, no, I think it has a really important role to play. It's one form of resistance. That's really good for raising awareness in communities abroad, and it's good for building, I think, communities of activists both here and in communities that are under Israeli control. I like that the BDS calls for three things: the end of military occupation, equal rights for Palestinians inside Israel, and the right of return for all refugees. And I think that's really, really important, because even in that language, that call has succeeded in unifying Palestinians in that it brings them all under that umbrella. And that's just really, really important.
Particularly the right of return, which is so often lost or not mentioned, or being willing to be negotiated away, not by Palestinians, but by, you know, sort of the negotiators.
Well, unfortunately, exactly, by Palestinian negotiators, right, unfortunately, right.
So that's really you know, that's really important.
It's important that it's a call from civil society also, I think, which is really good. I mean, that's both the positive and the negative of it, right? The positive of it is that it's perhaps speaking to an increased vibrancy in Palestinian civil society on this issue, right? And kind of a unity of that, you know, again, because it pulls together these different Palestinian communities. But the downside is that it speaks to the lack of a central, strong Palestinian leadership also, you know. It's evidence of that, I think.
Yeah. But it does reach, I mean, so many people in the United States somehow continue to look at the United States as being some kind of a non-interested party in trying to negotiate, you know. And, of course, they're very much in the Israeli camp. They are, there's no way that they're non-biased on this. But when you reach into the international community, as the BDS movement does, and you begin to see, you know, some big numbers in terms, and the financial community in some of these foreign countries joining BDS, then the hope is finally that you're going to reach beyond the United States, and that the international community, because it's the answer isn't here, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the problem in a way with also sort of consciousness raising and awareness raising and, you know, working on the media. I mean, we have to do those things because we can't but do them, I think. But, you know, I mean, we know that our foreign policy in this country is not determined by democratic elections, right?
No.
You know, it's determined by special interests. It's, you know, and all kinds of other things, right? And so it definitely makes me feel like we need to, as activists, sort of diversify our efforts and make sure that we, you know, we don't put all our eggs in one basket about, you know, for example, awareness raising or something like this.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time. I want to thank you.
Thank you.
This has been fascinating. And again, I loved your book. I hope people read it, Backstories.
Thanks a lot.
We've only touched on it, on the issue, and you really go into it, and you have some wonderful stories. And we weren't able to talk about Mazandana, and some of the people, some of the real heroes of the Palestinian press, and you deal with that beautifully. So I hope people buy and read your book.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Amal, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
That was an interview with Amal Bishara, professor of anthropology at Tufts University, who was a staunch advocate for the Palestinian people, as well as the author of the very informative book, Backstories, an exploration of the role Palestinians play in the news gathering in Palestine. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at www.wzbc.org. Or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive of past broadcasts, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson, go to truthandjusticeradio.org. All one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening to This Week in Palestine, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.